Welcome to DLC Live, your source for educational and inspirational interviews with mental health experts and advocates from around the world. Now, here's your host, creator of the DLC Anxiety Worldwide Mental Health Community, Dean Stott.
Hi, Kim. Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfect. How are you?
I'm good. I'm a little bit makeshift at the moment. I'm actually in my brother's house, but I made it happen. Thank you for being so accommodating. Apologies for my ignorance towards your daylight, summer, or timing, or whatever it is. But yeah, thank you for making it happen.
You're not, to be honest with you, I woke up yesterday and I didn't even know it was daylight savings.
We have the same here, but I think there's like a two week difference or something until it happened. So you always get that crossover period where you guys, well, there's an extra hour, yeah?
Yes. We'll know for next week. I'll Google it for sure.
We do have the moderator button. I haven't actually announced it, so we'll go in fresh and see what happens regarding the trolls. But let's just get into it, Kim. So today I want to speak about CBT techniques and how we can start to introduce it to parents for the children. And it's a passion of mine to try and get it into schools at an early age. And just the benefits of what basic CBT techniques can be really a useful tool and basic psychoeducation for children as they're growing up in the world, obviously, how it is now and with mental health, like us speaking about it, being on the forefront, which is wonderful. Do you know what I mean? When I was growing up and in school, and I'm sure you're the same, here's our wonderful bot, but I'm sure you're the same. It was never spoken about in schools.
Oh, no. Yeah. Never spoken about in school and probably not spoken about at home either. In fact, I know a lot of people, will say that their parents discourage talking about anxiety and sadness. And so I think it's home and it's school, which makes it particularly difficult.
Yeah, definitely. So regarding techniques that you think we can start to implement for children, from a therapist point of view, if just for example, if a parent came to you and said, hey, my child's told me that they're suffering with mental health, I can't actually see a therapist with them, is there anything that I can put in place so we can start to understand it together? What would you advise?
Well, I think there are some, I'll sort of give you, my go-to is actually some storybooks for kids. I think that it's helpful for kids to see that other kids have it. So there are some really great books that kids, and you can read to your kids. The reason I love that so much is it's being told as a story, but it's given in the form of psychoeducation. And the whole point of that is to really share, like, it's okay to have anxiety. Certain things will trigger anxiety, right? So that's absolutely going to happen. That there's nothing wrong with you if you have anxiety, right? And then it's also then teaching kids how to externalize their fear can be really helpful. So sometimes we give it a name. We may even like draw a picture of it. And then we can start to teach the child to have a dialogue with fear so that they don't feel like fear is telling them what to do. They can make their own decisions, they can make their own choices based on what's happening.
Fantastic. So would you say that that's more for children from like maybe like age 4, 5, 6? I think that you explaining that sounds like you say children who were picking up books that they're interested in and it having that psychoeducation element to it. And I have seen a few authors who do a really, really good job of that, and makes it fun to read about, isn't it? That it's not a boring topic that they're speaking about, something that they shouldn't really be worrying about as a child. I think it really works well. So just going up the ages, say we have a teenager and they're dealing with mental health issues and they spoke to their parent, and the parents come to you and said, is there any CBT technique? So we're past the books. Is there anything we can put in place, any practical things we can start to do to just make a little difference in our data? So understanding, thoughts, for example, and the physical sensations? What sort of things could they do?
Yeah, so I think the thing to, number one, teach children, the way what we teach it is actually, we call it the upstairs and the downstairs house. I actually did a whole podcast episode on this. It's actually a kid's technique, but we actually use it for adults as well, is to teach that.
We're all big kids.
Yeah, exactly. So imagine your brain is like a two-story house. So there's the upstairs house, which is where we make really good decisions. We make sort of, we work through things, we think them through and so forth. And then the downstairs is where our brain is constantly checking, right? For danger and fear and so forth. Now, sometimes the downstairs part of the brain, which is actually the amygdala, the part of the lower part of the brain, that downstairs part of the brain sets off alarm bells, right? Sets off, like, let's say a fire alarm, and makes the whole house think that there's danger, right? But what we want to teach kids to do is in that moment to stop and move, go up to the upstairs in terms of to go through and then work through ways that we can work through that anxiety, right? So it's first getting the kids to understand the difference between these different parts of the brain and why we have them, and that they're both important. Neither is wrong. But then so that in that moment, they can make sure first, am I using my downstairs brain and am I using my upstairs brain? Right? The upstairs, again, is where our executive functioning is. So then they can ask themselves, do I want to do what my fear is telling me to do? Right? Like, is it helpful for me to do what my fear is telling me to do? You may give it a name, Mr. Some kids, the younger kids call it like Mr. Poo-Poo Head or something silly like that. Older kids can give it a name like Mr. Meanie or Mr. Fear or Mrs. Terrible Story or whatever you want to call it. And then you can start to talk to fear. What a lot of kids and adults need to do as well is to learn how to stand up to that bully in our mind and say, no, I'm not doing that today, or I won't let you interfere with my playtime with my friends, or no, I really want to see this movie, so you don't get to tell me what to do, and so forth. So those kinds of skills can empower kids and also help them to be able to give names and narratives to these stories, and let, instead of them feeling like something is wrong with them.
Wonderful. No, I think that's really good advice. Regarding over there, now I know obviously the education systems are a little bit different, we're in different countries, but from what you know and the knowing about psychoeducation in schools, is it being implemented more now, or do you think there is still work that needs to be done? Are you seeing any differences?
Both. So I think that I've seen it be implemented, but I still think we have work to do. I will give you a proud moment, is my daughter at the very, when was that? Right after COVID, like when the kids went back to school, she was only 9 and she went to school and they had mindfulness week at the very beginning of the school year. And she, of course, like put her hand up and she knew exactly what mindfulness was. I was very proud. Right. I was so proud. But they did mindfulness week where all the kids learn mindfulness skills and they learn how to calm their body down. Sometimes it's helpful for them to have visuals. So her teacher made a glitter jar. I don't know if you've ever used a glitter jar, but it's basically a mason jar that's filled with liquid. And then inside is glitter. So you shake it up and that's what your brain looks like when it's anxious, right? Or angry. And then you put it on the table and it mindfully watch all the glitter fall down to the floor of the grab because of gravity. And it's teaching kids to learn how to pause and wait and sort of calm their body down. So I was so excited that they did that. Now, where are we falling short? Is I think that parents need to be taught this before kids are taught this, because so much of what a kid learns and how to manage difficult situations is what is modeled to them. So for me, I'm not perfect, but I try to model to my kids, like, mom's having a difficult time for a second. She's just going to take a second and step in and do some work here in calming herself down. I try to model that. I'm not always perfect, but I think parents need to learn that.
Do you label it as anxiety around your children?
If it's anxiety, that's what I'm feeling. If it's anger, if it's frustration, I try to do it with all the emotions, because these are the emotions that are commonly shamed, right? Anger, fear, frustration. So mostly those. But if it's fear, I would probably call it fear instead of anxiety, because I'm able to stay in the fear instead of it getting to be very catastrophic. But if they're experiencing anxiety,
sorry to interrupt. Do you find that's a hard situation? For example, say if the anxiety comes, you're with your children and you know that it's just anxiety playing its tricks and you're not in a fearful situation. Do you find it hard to say, I'm scared, I'm in this fearful situation, when you know that it's not a fearful situation? You don't want the children to pick up on, well, thinking, well, we're just in this situation, it's not fearful. Why is our mum thinking that way?
I think that it depends on the age. So I think if it was my 10-year-old, I would. If it was my 7-year-old, I probably wouldn't, because he's still at an age where he's looking to me and going, well, everything mum thinks must be true. Whereas my 10-year-old or that age group, I tend to be more able to sort of think about, like, just because mum thinks that way doesn't mean it's the facts, which is a part of their development. I think it depends.
It's mum thinks, like, when they get to 16, it's mum thinks that way, and that's completely false.
Yeah. I think it's like a downhill, like, thing, right? It's like, and then we just crash and they don't believe anything we say. I totally get that. Yeah, so I think that that's it. It depends on the age, and it also depends on their maturity as well, right? So I think, and the situation. So if, let's say, I'm super triggered, I actually probably am putting so much of my attention that I might just say, mommy has some strong emotions. Like, I think it's okay to also just say it's strong emotions for kids as well, particularly if they're going through a scary situation. Let's say here in California, we get lots of earthquakes. In that stage, I'd probably say strong emotions, because I don't want them to believe that earthquakes are terribly going, you know, dangerous and going to kill them, even though that is a possibility.
Yeah, no, that's really, I think that's really, really interesting and really helpful for people in the chat to realize that, just with the different ages going up, so the younger ones, they're looking up to mum, dad, and seeing, exploring the world with them almost, and having that relationship with them. And then, like you say, the older they get to the age when they just, like, yeah, mum and dad know nothing.
It's true. And at that age, let's say around 16 and so forth, modeling is so important, right? Because you're showing them, number one, our family doesn't stigmatize mental health, right? So if you're sharing with it, but then you're also regulating yourself, and that teaches them how to regulate themselves as well.
See, I think this is brilliant. And I don't know if it's a false comfort of me thinking it's brilliant, because obviously I'm speaking to you and we're both in the mental health communities as advocates and doing education and therapy. So I'm getting a different experience of it, because I'd like to think that all parents are doing this with the children. And I really hope they are doing. And obviously having conversations like this, it really helps them to say, well, yeah, maybe this is a cool idea. This makes sense. And this is going to make my child's life easier. It's going to make my life easier if they do come to me and we have to deal with anxiety together.
Right. The parents' instinct is to fix our kids' problems, right? We just want to swoop in and take their pain away. And the problem with that, I mean, that's beautiful in one sense, but the problem with that is a lot of parents swoop in too fast and too much and take away an opportunity for the child to actually learn how to have feelings, right? So let's say they're having something's bothering them, they're anxious about things, and the parent comes in and wants to give them reassurance right away, like, no, you've got nothing to worry about, that definitely won't happen. what you're actually doing is number one, you're creating a false sense of security, because most of the time parents don't have 100% guarantee things won't happen. But number two, it's a helpful just to be with your child and not swoop in and save them. And so you can actually let it unfold and let them have the experience while you're with them, but not rescuing them. And that's really hard for parents.
Yeah, because like you say, it's like, it's always an innate response, isn't it? Like the anxious response is this innate response. So is that response of protecting our child and not wanting any discomfort for them whatsoever. Even if we know that anxiety is not harmful, blah, 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 it's still that response of motherhood, parenthood, isn't it? Tim, so the great thing is when you turn comments off, we still get questions, which is fantastic. So I can see some questions are coming. I don't know if you knew that, by the way, so that's super helpful. So if you don't have a moderator, you can still turn the comments off and people can still engage with us. So I'm still getting the hearts on the screen and I'm still getting questions. So I think it's a great time for me to just pop in the questions and have a look. The first question, Kim, is, my child deals with anger a lot, and I feel like I can relate to them speaking with anger. Is anxiety just a different emotion, and should I treat it the same way? I think that's a great question.
Well, from psychologically, we usually understand anger as an emotion that shows up when we want to protect ourselves, right? So anger is more of the fight. We have fight, flight, and freeze, and anger usually shows up in a fight way. We're trying to protect ourselves when we've perceived danger or someone's crossed a limit with us. Usually what's underneath anger is usually sadness or fear, sometimes loneliness or sometimes shame. So I think that you can show up exactly the same way, knowing that underneath that anger is often, not always, but often another emotion. An example might be, one kid kind of said something to them on the field, something about, can judge them in some way. Their response is to show up in anger. But deeper underneath that is the fear that they won't be connected or they won't be understood, or maybe they're afraid of being shunned and thrown out of the group of kids. So I think it's helpful to really sit with kids, and then it's not about getting to the bottom of it, because you might not ever get to the bottom. Kids don't always have the words, but you can ask some simple question like, wow, I'm wondering if there's, is there anything else you're struggling with? Or is there anything else underneath the fear that you might be feeling? So it's sometimes helpful just to ask some simple questions.
That's wonderful. And is that the same way that you would explore that in the therapy room? So if someone came with anger as the manifestation, you would look to see, is there anxiety behind that, or is there another emotion? Yeah,
I think the first thing I should have said, though, is one of the best tools you can do with kids is just to repeat back what they've said. So if they're like, I'm really angry at such and such, you can respond back by going, it makes total sense that you're angry with such and such. It helps us validate them, and that will soothe their nervous system so that they can express themselves. Like I said, the upstairs and the downstairs, if you're only responding as from downstairs, you can't share and communicate and be in relation with people. So sometimes just validating them can be very beneficial.
And the great question is, what if the parent thinks that it's not a valid situation to validate?
Well, I think as a parent, our job is to really go into our curiosity, which is we have our own experience of things, but that doesn't mean it's the right experience. And that through curiosity, you can actually then understand your child. Sometimes they might say, I hate school.
The answer, honestly, Kim, great answer.
Right? They might say, I hate school. And you might go, you go to a great school. You have no reason to hate your school. But in that sentence, there is a great opportunity to ask some questions to understand it mightn't be about school at all. It might be that he's struggling with math and he's humiliated because all of his friends know. Or he's really anxious because there's a part of the school that creeps him out and he doesn't want to be around that creeped out place, right? And so it's important to ask questions. There's usually, they don't tell, no kid is going to go straight and say, I'm afraid of that one gate at school. It's usually going to be a blanket statement. So ask some questions.
No, absolutely wonderful. Perfect answer, Ken. Perfect.
10 out of 10. Next question.
Great. Another good question. My child gets anxious in the class, but he's scared of telling the teacher in front of anyone. Do you have any advice?
Yeah. So hopefully you're in a school where you should be able to back channel your teacher and have private conversations. So we in our school, we have a back channel where if I have any concerns, I can message the teacher and say, I'm
sorry.
Back channel meaning I can have a conversation with the teacher without it being in public in front of all of his or her friends. So I wouldn't go and address the teacher at drop off or pickup where everyone would see. I would email them, or often schools have like a portal you can message them with. I think it's important that we as parents can communicate with the teacher. And if you can't, you should be communicating with the principal, because it often is, number one, a misunderstanding between the teacher and the child, or the teacher may completely not understand your child and what your child's going through. Now, at the beginning of the year, I often will send an email to either of my children's teachers and explain to them, here are the things that we are our strengths and here are the things that are our challenges, so that up front, we've already started a dialogue with the teacher on how they can serve my child as best as they can. It doesn't have to be long. I'm not going to use up their precious time because teachers are already putting in extra time. But I think it's okay to have that back channel communication from the start, and that can actually help throughout the year if you run into those troubles.
Yeah, I did want to actually say, and it's not plugging my book, but I've actually had quite a few teachers saying, hey, children are coming to us. I imagine you've had it the same. Saying children are coming to us and really speaking and talking openly about mental health, but we just don't have the resources out there. Yeah. And I've had a few teachers saying that they're going to buy the book and other books and actually create mental health libraries for the children.
Yeah, I think if they can do that, particularly with your book so beautifully written, they should, right? And that's the thing. And it's so great too, is like, especially, I'm going to be very general, but for a young teen boy to read a man who's telling the story, I think also helps break that stigma and be like, okay, so other men are talking about it. I think that is so brilliant as well.
Right. And next question. Some great questions today, Ken. Yeah, I'm blown away by the question today. So I have an allergy to a certain food. My child has picked up that I have this allergy, and it's put them off not eating the food. And they've actually said in the back of their mind, they think this is a good thing because they're actually worried that they might be allergic to it. Do you think this is good or bad behavior?
I wouldn't say it's either. I think it's normal behavior, right? If you avoid.
That instinct,
sorry,
that protection instinct, isn't it, straight away?
Yeah. And so what I would encourage, I mean, it's neither good nor bad. It depends on whether it's impacting the child's functioning is where I would like ask, like, is it impacting their ability to go to parties? Is it impacting their ability to travel? Do they have a lot of anxiety at lunch? If that's happening, well, then yes, I would say that it's something to keep an eye out for. What I would say to do here is if you have another trusted adult, to have short periods with your child where they go out and they eat the thing that you're allergic to together, so that the other adult can model that it's okay to eat it. And so that you might find that the child just needed that other modeling to learn that it's okay for him or her to have that food item. But if it's impacting,
be worried, and I don't know, they think that maybe it's passed down. I guess that surely with a doctor, there's certain tests they'd be able to do as well to see if there is an allergy, yeah?
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely food allergy, extensive food allergy tests, which may actually reinforce that as well. So absolutely.
No, I think that's great. Next question. So it's actually, I mean, I don't know their age, but it says that they speak to their parent and tell them that they're anxious, but they're just being dismissed. Do you have any advice to get through to the parent? Firstly, we're very sorry, obviously, that you're dealing with that. And there is so much support out there, and it doesn't mean, just because they're not obviously taking it seriously, doesn't mean that that you're not suffering with anxiety or anything like that. Don't ever think that because your parent's dismissing it, because it's your parent, that means that you're not dealing with something right.
So exactly it. I mean, you can always try. Often I will encourage people to either get some printouts from reliable sources and take it to the parents and say, like, this is exactly what I'm going through. And that sometimes can be enough for the parent to listen. But there are always those parents who, for cultural or religious or for family systems reasons, or there may be their own personality challenges, just can't take on other people's suffering. And if that's the case, just do your best to find someone, a school counselor, a teacher, a mentor, a friend, a friend's parent, and just start to ask if they have any help, resources or help for you. And ideally, somebody will be there to support you and validate what you're going through.
And I always say, obviously, the people who are on our communities, show them the Instagram, show them a community of so many people who are going through these things, and show explore the psychoeducation together. Mm-hmm. So what you can relate to, and then have that discussion, ask to go to a doctor, first protocol. If you can access therapy, can a child go, they can go together, obviously, with the parent, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That happens a lot.
Yeah, and another thing is at your yearly pediatrician appointment, you may ask, can I have a little bit of time with a doctor alone? And then ask to have some time without the parent in the room where you share that you're going through something. Maybe the doctor has some resources that can help you, and that can often help as well.
Fantastic. Right, I'll do one more question, Kim, and then I will let you go. I really appreciate you shifting things around.
No, my pleasure. It was like you, the whole day has been upside down. I have, like, everything is upside down today.
The last question is, can high levels of stress due to deadlines and exams cause anxiety?
Yes, 100%.
Why?
Well, okay, so when you have a lot of deadlines, stress, expectations being placed on you, your brain, the part of your brain that actually sends off alarms that there is danger, is in high alert, right? Particularly if you're not getting a lot of sleep, maybe you're not eating a lot, you're staying up pulling all-nighters. So that part of your brain is going to be on high alert. And often that's when someone will have their very first panic attack or an anxiety attack, or they may have depersonalization or derealization. And then that in and of itself will just get the snowball going. And so, yes, when stress is such a huge thing that impacts so many parts of our body. And so, yes, if you can manage your stress, a lot of people find their anxiety actually goes down a little as well.
And if I was to ask you for three things, your three main things to help someone manage stress, what would your three go-to things be?
Number one, make sure these are more behavioral techniques. So number one would be try to get as much sleep as you can. Sleep is very helpful at slowing down our nervous system. Number two, try and get some exercise. Again, these are things to slow down and regulate your nervous system. And the third thing is be aware of catastrophic thinking. Again, stress is often from an overload of things to do. But more importantly, it's often because we've catastrophized the things that we're doing. So let's say you have a deadline and you're on deadline. That in and of itself is stressful. But as you're on deadline and you're typing and you're having catastrophic thoughts like, if I don't get this, I'll lose my job or I'll lose my friends or I'll fail this class. The catastrophic thinking can actually, again, amp up that nervous system and create more and more anxiety. I always say catastrophic thinking is like injecting yourself with like cortisol or adrenaline, right? It's like adding to the stress and anxiety you already have. So to keep an eye out for that catastrophic thinking.
With that catastrophic thinking, what's the reason that you think that we almost trick ourselves in that situation to almost believe that story that we've created, like you say? So because you're thinking about a deadline and you're worried that if you don't do it, that's going to happen. What's the reason, do you think, that that story is almost enforced into being believable? Do you think it is because of the physical sensations and the ruminating on the issue? What would you say is behind it?
It can be that, right? So just because we experience it with anxiety, it feels real. And that can be why. It also is that we have this just in case system in our brain where we think that if it's possible and we put our attention on that, we'll somehow protect ourselves from that. But putting so much attention on it actually makes it feel more believable. So it could be that sort of just in case. I'll think about it just in case. A lot of people actually find that I've worked with is they focus on the catastrophe because that helps motivate them to get the work done. But the problem with that is if that's your only way of motivating, you have to get so anxious in order to be motivated. And that can cause a massive problem. So, you know, it's ideal for you to say, well, that is one option. There are also many other options, which could be, I could do quite well. I could actually excel, or let's just practice being uncertain and just focus on getting it done.
So moving away from the just in case, basically, isn't it? Moving away. And like you say, nothing is guaranteed. You can plan for every outcome and then something happen. You can only control the things that are in your control. And yeah, anything external, it becomes anxiety and fear and stress because, well, like you say, this just in case, there'll always be a just in case, won't there?
Yeah, always, always.
Fantastic. Kim, let everyone know. So I put my stories about your fantastic course that you've got out. If you let everyone know, you're still doing the time management course as well, which is fantastic. People at a price, really, really cheap. That's still up for grabs as well. Just let everyone know where they can find you, what courses, what CBT school is. The floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you. No, so you can see me at Your Anxiety Toolkit on Instagram. Dean has all the links to the courses, so go there if you have OCD or you want some time management skills, which are core for stress management, if that's what you're struggling with. We have other courses on the way that are coming out as well. And so they're there. We have Your Anxiety Toolkit, which is a podcast if you're wanting like weekly mindfulness, you know, tips and tools. And that's it. I'm so happy to be.
The podcast, I went onto the webpage as well. Looks fantastic, Kim. You've done a great job.
Thank you.
Only obviously from being on the podcast and seeing that it looks fantastic, and no wonder you've got so many over a million downloads, right?
Yeah, over a million downloads, and yeah, it's so exciting to have people be helped. Again, my hope was it's just practical tools, so if that's what you need, place to go.
Yeah, sorry, my battery just went, so I think it paused a little bit. But yeah, Kim, thank you for being you. Thanks for being accommodating. Lovely chat. I think a lot of people get a lot from this chat. And yeah, we'll do it again in a couple of weeks. I'm sure we'll have an exciting topic to discuss.
Yeah. All right. All my love to you.
You take care. Yeah.
You've been listening to DLC Live. Be sure to follow Dean on Instagram at DLC Anxiety. Check our website at dlcanxiety.com and grab yourself a copy of our latest book, Greater Than Panic, on Amazon today. See you next time.